This CLE is based on appellate decisions released in October of 2019, which dealt with issues related to negligence. The summaries of these decisions were posted on the website, New York Appellate Digest, in October 2019, and they've since been compiled into a pamphlet, the October 2019 Negligence Update Pamphlet. It is that pamphlet which serves as the written materials for this CLE, and the page references are to the pages of the pamphlet. First case is 517 Union Street Associates. It's on page 4, and it has to do with the criteria for a tort cause of action that arises out of a contract. Third Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the negligence cause of action was really a breach of contract action, and therefore the negligence cause of action should have been dismissed. The underlying contract was for demolition and construction work, and the complaint alleged damage by the diversion of water. The court wrote, "We agree with J. Luke," that's the demolition construction contractor, "that the negligence cause of action should have been dismissed. Town Homes," that's the property owner, "denominated that claim as one for negligence, alleging that J. Luke deviated from accepted standards of care by failing to perform contracted for demolition and construction work in a good and workmanlike manner." Supreme Court correctly categorized those assertions as a claim for negligence performance of a contract. The problem is that a simple breach of contract is not to be considered a tort unless a legal duty independent of the contract itself has been violated. Town Homes never suggested that J. Luke owed it a duty of care independent from the contract, and confirmed in its opposition to J. Luke's motion that the issue was whether J. Luke rendered subpar performance under the contract. Accordingly, in the absence of any indication that J. Luke owed an independent duty to Town Homes arising from circumstances extraneous to and not constituting elements of the contract, J. Luke was entitled to summary judgment dismissing the negligence cause of action. The next case is Carter on pages 4 and 5. It's an elevator injury case, and it illustrates the application of the res ipsa loquitur doctrine. First Department held that the res ipsa loquitur doctrine may apply to this elevator malfunction case, and defendant's motion for summary judgment was properly denied. The court said summary judgment was properly denied in this action where plaintiff was injured when the elevator door in defendant's building closed unexpectedly on her hand as she attempted to exit. Defendant has failed to establish as a matter of law that res ipsa loquitur is inapplicable to this case. In order for the doctrine to apply, three elements must be established. 1. The event must be of a kind which ordinarily does not occur in the absence of someone's negligence. 2. It must be caused by an agency or instrumentality within the exclusive control of the defendant. And 3. It must not have been due to any voluntary action or contribution on the part of the plaintiff. The rule has the effect of creating a prima facie case of negligence sufficient for submission to the jury, and the jury may, but is not required to, draw the permissible inference. Next is the DiGiddio case, or DiGiddio, on pages 5 and 6. It raises an Espinal issue, which is whether a contract can give rise to tort liability to a third party, to someone who is not a party to the contract. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that plaintiff's motion for summary judgment on his Labor Law 241 cause of action should have been granted in this crane accident case. The First Department also held that the negligence action against the company, Hoffman, which refurbished and maintained the crane, based upon the Espinal launched an instrument of harm theory, should not have been dismissed. The court said, Hoffman refurbished the subject crane 1 year before the accident and performed maintenance on it several times thereafter. Although a contractual obligation standing alone will generally not give rise to tort liability in favor of a third person, an exception exists where a contractor who undertakes to perform services pursuant to a contract negligently creates or exacerbates a dangerous condition so as to have launched a force or instrument of harm. And it cites the Espinal case, which is Espinal versus Melville Snow Contractors, 98 New York 2nd, 136, 2002 case. Hoffman failed to adequately address the findings of an independent crane company that conducted the post-accident information, which concluded that several maintenance and repair issues contributed to overwear on the crane's wire ropes, which obviously contributed to the accident. So the Espinal cause of action survived in that case. Next is the Martin case on pages 6 and 7. It's a medical malpractice case which presents an unusual issue. The surgeon couldn't remember doing the operation and sought to introduce evidence of his custom and practice to prove how the operation was performed. Second Department, reversing the defense verdict in a medical malpractice case, held the trial court should not have allowed the defendant doctor, who had no independent memory of the hernia surgery that he performed on the plaintiff, to testify about his usual custom and practice or habit. The surgery involved placement of a mesh patch on the abdominal wall. In this case, a portion of the patch had come off the wall and adhered to internal organs. The court said, custom and practice evidence draws its probative value from the repetition and unvarying uniformity of the procedure involved, as it depends on the inference that a person who regularly follows a strict routine in relation to a particular repetitive practice is likely to have followed that same strict routine at a specific date or time relevant to the litigation. To justify the introduction of habit evidence, a party must be able to show on voir dire to the satisfaction of the court that the party expects to prove a sufficient number of instances of the conduct in question. Although habit evidence may be admissible in a medical malpractice action where the defendant physician makes the requisite showing, here the evidence did not demonstrate that the defendant's suturing of the Kugel Composites mesh patch represented a deliberate and repetitive practice by a person in complete control of the circumstances. So again, the defense verdict was reversed in that case. Next is the Zurich American Insurance Company case on page 8. It's a municipal law case, and it concerns that rare circumstance when a municipality performing a governmental function may be held liable because a special relationship had been formed with the plaintiffs. Second Department held the complaint sufficiently alleged the formation of a special relationship with plaintiffs by the Fire District of New York, FDNY. This was a fire. When they arrived, this is the language of the court. When they arrived, FDNY personnel observed a fire on storage shelves approximately 50 feet into the building. Upon concluding that the fire was being controlled by the building's sprinkler system, FDNY personnel wet down the debris, then turned off the main water valve that controlled the flow of water to the entire sprinkler system, rendering it inoperable. After certifying to warehouse personnel that the building was safe to re-enter, FDNY personnel left the premises. Within minutes, a warehouse employee observed an orange glow toward the center of the warehouse, and a second fire alarm was activated. However, because the sprinkler system had been disabled by FDNY personnel, the fire spread quickly and destroyed the entire building and its contents. A municipality may not be held liable for negligent performance of a governmental function, such as police and fire protection, absent a duty born of a special relationship between the injured plaintiff and the defendant municipality. A special relationship may arise in three situations. 1, when the municipality violates a statutory duty enacted for the benefit of a particular class of person. 2, when it voluntarily assumes a duty that generates justifiable reliance by the person who benefits from the duty. Or 3, when it assumes positive direction and control in the face of a known, blatant, and dangerous safety violation. Here the plaintiff's allegations that FDNY personnel, upon arriving at the scene and assuming control over the ongoing fire, shut off the main water supply valve to the warehouse's sprinkler systems, then certified to warehouse employees that it was safe to re-enter the building, when in fact the fire was still at risk of rekindling, which it did within minutes after FDNY personnel left the premises. These facts are sufficient to establish a special relationship. Next is the City of New York versus Tri-Rail Construction on page 9. It's a Court of Appeals case, a small memorandum. The Court of Appeals reversing Supreme Court held that the city has the capacity to sue for the negligent destruction of city property. The city sought money damages for injury to trees caused by the sidewalk repairs performed by defendants for the adjacent property owner. And the court said, the city has the general capacity to sue for negligent destruction of its property. Next is Henry versus Hamilton Equities. It's on pages 9 and 10. It's another Court of Appeals case. It has to do with the liability of a tenant versus an out-of-possession landlord in a slip-and-fall case. The Court of Appeals, in a full-fledged opinion by Judge Stein, over a two-judge dissenting opinion, held the owner of a nursing home, Hamilton, as an out-of-possession landlord, was not liable to plaintiff who slipped and fell on the premises. It was alleged the pool of water which caused plaintiff to slip and fall was the result of a leak in the roof. The lease had made the tenant's name is Grand Manor, responsible for repairs. However, a HUD regulatory agreement subsequently entered in by Hamilton, that's the owner of the nursing home, in connection with an FHA mortgage, required that the property be kept in good repair by Hamilton. The Court of Appeals held that the regulatory agreement did not change the terms of the lease, so the out-of-possession landlord was not liable. The court said, the HUD regulatory agreement, as incorporated into the 1978 amendment to the lease, did not alter the contractual relationship between the Hamilton defendants, the property owners, and Grand Manor, the tenant, regarding control of the premises, or replace Grand Manor's contractual duty to perform maintenance and repairs at the facility. Although the terms of the HUD agreement were to supersede all other requirements in conflict with it, the regulatory agreement did not conflict with or absolve Grand Manor of its responsibilities under the original lease. As previously noted, the amendment continued all terms from the lease that did not conflict with the regulatory agreement. Given the absence of a conflict on the issue of Grand Manor's duties to make repairs, the HUD agreement, as incorporated into the lease agreement, was not a covenant that could be said to displace Grand Manor's duties or alter the relationship between landlord and tenant. Next is the Adeo case, or Adeo. On pages 10 and 11, it's another slip-and-fall landlord-tenant, out-of-possession landlord case. The Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that defendant landlord's motion for summary judgment in this slip-and-fall case should have been granted. Although there was a dangerous condition, defendant, as an out-of-possession landlord, was not responsible for its repair. The court said, defendant submitted the lease between defendant and plaintiff's employer, which provided that the lessee was responsible for all maintenance and repair of the premises except for major improvements. which the lease defined as any major repairs that are not of the nature of ordinary maintenance, such as local patches, caulking, and flashing, including replacement of the roof, replacement of load-bearing walls and foundations, and repairs to the concrete floor. We conclude that maintenance of the allegedly bent or defective metal strip that caused the fall was not a major improvement under the lease. Further, the record established that defendant relinquished control of the premises. The fact that under the lease, defendant reserved the right to enter the leased premises for purposes of inspection and performing major improvements is insufficient to establish the requisite degree of control necessary for the imposition of liability with respect to an out-of-possession landlord. An out-of-possession landlord who reserves that right may be held liable for injuries to a third party only where a specific statutory violation exists, and plaintiff failed to allege a specific statutory violation pertaining to the metal strip which caused the fall. Next is the Xiang Fu He case, Xiang Fu He. It's another slip and fall case, and it's another landlord-tenant case which involves municipal law. It's a Court of Appeals case in a full-fledged opinion by Judge Rivera, reversing the appellate division. The court held that the New York City Administrative Code provision, which requires the abutting landowners to maintain the city's sidewalks, applies to out-of-possession landlords, even where the tenant is responsible for maintaining the sidewalks under the lease. The court wrote, Section 7-210 of the Administrative Code of the City of New York unambiguously imposes a non-delegable duty on certain real property owners to maintain city sidewalks abutting their land in a reasonably safe condition. Under this duty of care, a subject owner is liable for personal injury claims arising from the owner's negligent failure to remove snow and ice from the sidewalk. The code makes no exception for out-of-possession landowners, and so we hold that the duty applies with full force, notwithstanding an owner's transfer of possession to a lessee or maintenance agreement with a non-owner. Thus, defendants are not entitled to summary judgment as a matter of law due solely to the owner's out-of-possession status. So where there is an administrative code which requires, a municipal code which requires the owner of property to maintain a city sidewalk, even if that owner is an out-of-possession landlord, and even if that landlord has a lease agreement making the tenants responsible for maintaining the city sidewalk, the out-of-possession landlord can still be liable. Next is Matter of Montero, which is on page 12. It's another slip and fall involving municipal law. This time, the issue is whether a late notice of claim should have been filed or accepted. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held petitioner's motion for leave to file a late notice of claim in this slip and fall case should have been granted. Although the excuse was inadequate, the city had actual notice and was not prejudiced by the delay. The court wrote, petitioner's assertion that he was unaware of the requirement that he file a notice of claim within 90 days of his accident is not a reasonable excuse for failing to file a timely notice. His contention that his injuries prevented him from timely filing a notice of claim is not an acceptable excuse because he failed to provide any medical documentation to support his claimed incapacity. Notwithstanding, his failure to establish a reasonable excuse for not timely filing a notice of claim is not fatal. The city obtained actual notice of the accident within a reasonable time after the 90-day period expired. It does not contest petitioner's assertion that the condition of the hole, which caused him to fall, remained unchanged at the time he sought leave to file the late notice. Although petitioner does not address whether anyone saw the accident, the bare claim that the delay would make it difficult for the city to locate witnesses is insufficient to establish prejudice. So the application or the motion for leave to file a late notice should have been granted in that case. Next is Rubenstein on pages 12 and 13. It's another slip and fall involving municipal law, this time involving the adequacy of the notice of claim. The second department determined the complaint in the slip and fall case was properly dismissed. The complaint alleged a theory of liability which was not described in the notice of claim. The court said, a notice of claim which sufficiently identifies the claimant, states the nature of the claim, and describes the time when, the place where, and the manner in which the claim arose, is a condition precedent to asserting a tort claim against a municipality. Although the statute does not require those things to be stated with literal nicety or exactness, a notice of claim must provide information sufficient to enable the city to investigate and must at least adequately apprise the defendant that the claimant would seek to impose liability under a cognizable theory of recovery. A plaintiff may not later add a new theory of liability that was not included in the notice of claim. Here, the city established its prima facie entitlement to summary judgment dismissing the complaint by submitting evidence that the notice of claim contained no allegation that the city caused or created the icy condition where the accident occurred by negligently maintaining a nearby sewer and failing to repair an alleged recurring flooding condition from the sewer backup. Next is the Rojecki case on page 13, another slip and fall case. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff had raised a question of fact whether the painted areas of a crosswalk in a parking lot constituted a dangerous condition in this slip and fall case. Plaintiff's expert presented evidence the painted areas were very slippery when wet and sand should have been added to the paint. The court said, the plaintiff raised a triable issue of fact as to whether the painted lines constituted a dangerous or defective condition. The plaintiff submitted the affidavit of his expert, who opined that the painted surface was non-slip when dry, but became very slippery when wet. The plaintiff's expert further opined that when coatings are applied in an area where people are expected to walk, particularly areas exposed to wet conditions, either sand is added to provide traction or a coating that is slip resistant under wet conditions is used. He also noted that in other areas of the parking lot where the accident occurred, a different coating was used and that coating was slip resistant under wet conditions. Next is Van Duzer, which is on page 14, another slip and fall case, this time involving tracked in water. The third department held defendant's motion for summary judgment in this slip and fall case was properly granted. Plaintiff was unable to demonstrate that the source of the water on which she slipped and fell was not simply tracked in rain, which was not actionable. The floor in question was temporary flooring used in a tent set up for a graduation ceremony. The court wrote, property owners are not required to cover all of their floors with mats, nor to continuously mop up all moisture resulting from tracked-in rain. Further, even assuming that water was present on the temporary flooring at issue, the mere fact that a floor or walkway becomes slippery when wet does not establish a dangerous condition. Next is Rojas, R-O-J-A-S, pages 14 and 15. It's relevant to lawsuits brought against a public authority. In this case, it was the New York City Transit Authority. The Second Department noted that the public authorities law allows only 3% interest from the date of the verdict in an action against the New York City Transit Authority. Plaintiff was injured while driving when a piece of metal fell from elevated tracks through the windshield. The nearly $2 million verdict was affirmed. The court said, after a trial on the issue of damages, the jury returned a verdict in favor of the plaintiff and against the defendants in the principal sums of $800,000 for past pain and suffering and $1 million for future pain and suffering over a 15-year period. the defendants appeal from a judgment in favor of the plaintiff and against them in the total of approximately $2 million, including interest in the sum of approximately $64,000. The judgment incorrectly applied an interest rate in excess of the maximum legal rate of 3% per annum to the plaintiff's award against the defendants. And it cites Public Authorities Law, Section 1212, Subdivision 6. We therefore remit the matter for recalculation of interest at the rate of 3% per annum from the date of the verdict. Next is the Higashi case on pages 15 and 16. It's a pedestrian vehicle accident case. The plaintiff was crossing the entrance to a parking lot when she was struck by the defendant's car, and apparently the defendant testified that he never saw her. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff pedestrian's motion for summary judgment in this traffic accident case should have been granted. Plaintiff was halfway through the entrance to a parking lot when defendant turned to enter the parking lot. The court wrote, plaintiff submitted a transcript of the deposition testimony of a non-party witness who testified that just before the impact, he observed the injured plaintiff turn her body to face the defendant's vehicle and put her hands up in front of her. He then saw the vehicle strike the injured plaintiff and launch her into the air. A driver is bound to see what there is to be seen with the proper use of his or her senses. Here, the plaintiffs established their prima facie entitlement to judgment as a matter of law on the issue of liability by submitting evidence that the defendant driver never saw the injured plaintiff before striking her. At this point, I'm going to insert the verification code to be put on the attorney affirmation. The verification code for this October 2019 negligence update CLE is IMPACT. Again, the verification code for this October 2019 negligence update CLE is IMPACT. Next is the Kante case, K-A-N-T-E, on page 17. It illustrates the difference between proximate cause and simply furnishing the occasion for an accident. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the Perez defendant's motion for summary judgment in this rear-end collision case should not have been granted. Perez stopped his vehicle in the left lane behind a disabled vehicle when the driver of the disabled vehicle flagged him down. Plaintiff came to a stop behind the Perez vehicle and was attempting to go around the Perez vehicle when plaintiff's vehicle was struck from behind by the Chen vehicle. The Second Department held that the Perez vehicle furnished the condition for the traffic accident but did not cause the accident. The accident was caused by Chen's failure to maintain a safe distance. The court wrote, the evidence demonstrated that Perez's conduct of stopping his vehicle in the left lane of travel with its hazard lights engaged was not a proximate cause of the collision between Chen's SUV and the plaintiff's vehicle, but rather merely furnished the condition or occasion for it. Since the plaintiff was able to safely bring his vehicle to a complete stop behind Perez's vehicle, where it remained stopped for approximately 2 minutes prior to the accident, any purported negligence on Perez's part was not a proximate cause of the collision between Chen's SUV and the plaintiff's vehicle or of the plaintiff's injuries. The sole proximate cause of the accident was Chen's failure to maintain a safe driving speed and distance behind the plaintiff's vehicle. And the final case in this October 2019 negligence CLE is on page 18. I can't pronounce the name. It's K-M-I-O-T-E-K. It's a zone of danger case. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the petition for leave to file a late notice of claim against the school district should not have been granted. The petitioners are the parents of students who were participating in football training when the pole or log they were carrying dropped and fatally injured another student. The late notice of claim asserted intentional and negligent infliction of emotional distress based upon the petitioner's children being in the zone of danger. However, the zone of danger theory can be raised only by the immediate relatives of an injured party. The court wrote, "The zone of danger rule allows one who is himself or herself threatened with bodily harm in consequence of the defendant's negligence to recover for emotional distress resulting from viewing the death or serious physical injury of a member of his or her immediate family." Here, the petitioner's children were not immediate family members of the decedent. Thus, they have no legally cognizable claim to recover damages for emotional distress that they allegedly sustained from witnessing the accident. And that concludes this October 2019 negligence update CLE.